chapter 20, verse 4. Then I saw thrones, and seated on them were those to whom judgment was committed. Also I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their testimony to Jesus and for the word of God, and who had not worshipped the beast or its image and had not received its mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Our first question, does verse 4 describe a future situation or a past situation? Well, let's look for a clue. There's a clue in the verse itself. We've seen this same cast of characters before. The martyrs, the beast. If we're correct that this beast is Rome, then this chapter, and in fact this verse, is still talking about Rome. And isn't that what we would expect? This entire book has been building toward the climax that we find in these final, beautiful 3 chapters. Do we really expect God to suddenly change the subject now that He has reached this grand conclusion? Well, who are on the thrones there in verse 4? It can be none other than the church. Jesus promised in chapters 2 and 3 that those who overcame would share His rule over the nations. And that is exactly what we see here for those who overcame, who came out of that Roman situation and did not compromise with Rome. They are sharing the rule as they too sit upon thrones. In addition to seeing the church as a whole, John also sees individual Christians. Those who were killed, beheaded is the word that's used here, by Rome. He sees the martyrs who were killed because they would not worship the beast. They did not bow the knee to the beast and compromise with Rome. He sees them here too. It was their cry from under the altar that prompted this judgment. And here they are at the end, after that judgment has happened. And we're seeing it described. Had these Christians been defeated? Hardly. Revelation rings throughout with the message that death is not a defeat for a Christian. Defeat would have occurred if these Christians had compromised with Rome, if they had renounced Jesus in order to save their lives here on earth. That would have been the defeat. Matthew 16:25, whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake, Jesus says, will find it. The only defeated Christians were those who renounced their faith, who compromised with Rome. They were the ones who were defeated. Well, what happens to these martyrs? They live and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. The Revised Standard Version more accurately reads, they came to life and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. They are like the 2 witnesses we saw earlier in our study. They appeared to have been killed and defeated by Rome, but all was not as it seemed. They came to life. They had not been killed at all. And that's what we see here again with these martyrs. Is this resurrection of the martyrs literal or figurative? Well, you know, our general rule, of course, in apocalyptic language is to interpret it figuratively, unless there's something that forces us to interpret it literally. There's nothing like that here. This is figurative. In fact, the Bible includes many figurative resurrections. Daniel 12, verse 2, for example, is a figurative resurrection speaking of the time when the Messiah would come in and the light would dawn on those who had been in darkness. And in fact, Simeon in Luke chapter 2, verse 34, points to that same figurative resurrection as having occurred when Jesus came into this world. Isaiah 26:19, Hosea 13, verse 14, also examples of figurative resurrections. And that's what we see here. What does this particular one represent here in verse 4? It depicts the exact same thing, but in a different setting, that Ezekiel saw all the way back in Ezekiel 37, in the Valley of Dry Bones. You remember that? Ezekiel saw a bodily resurrection in the Valley of Dry Bones in Ezekiel 37. And in verse 11 of that chapter, God told him that those bones were the house of Israel who had lost all their hope. They'd lost their hope. And that return, that restoration of their hope was shown by those bones coming back to life and being raised from the dead. That was the restoration of their hope. Things looked bleak, but God brought them back. That was the restoration of the hope. That's the beautiful image we see here. Does that interpretation fit with this context? Of course it perfectly fits with this context. These martyrs are figuratively raised to life to show the restoration of their hope. that the church was experiencing at this time. In Ezekiel, the symbol depicted the national restoration of God's people from Babylonian captivity. Fast forward to Revelation, the same symbols used to depict the restoration of God's people from Roman captivity. What happens after they come to life? They reign with Christ for 1,000 years. Well, what does that mean? We know what that means. We already know what that means. It means their restoration is completely complete. That's what it means. Their victory over Rome is just as complete as was Satan's defeat with regard to Rome. Those two events are two sides of the same coin. If one is 1,000 years, then the other one has to be 1,000 years. Completely complete. That's what this symbol means. We've seen it already in this book. And note that they will reign with Christ for 1,000 years. With Christ. You often hear people talk about the 1,000-year reign of Christ. But where is that mentioned anywhere in these verses? The reign of Christ for 1,000 years. It's the reign with Christ. The 1,000-year period denotes the reign of these martyrs with Christ. There's no time limit given here, figuratively or otherwise, on the duration of Christ's reign. Finally, we should recall our earlier comments about people who build elaborate religious theories on a single verse from the book of Revelation. Isn't it odd that such an important theory as premillennialism, important in their own minds, is not mentioned anywhere else in the Bible? If premillennialism were true, then wouldn't we have expected Paul to mention it somewhere in all of his many letters? Instead, what we read from Paul is something very, very different from premillennialism. He refutes it over and over again in his letters. He doesn't mention it ever. Verse 5. Let me mention before we get to verse 5, the handout. The handout goes into quite a bit of detail on premillennialism. There's also a lesson on premillennialism from our series on thought-provoking questions. About a year or so ago, we had a series of classes in the auditorium that went through a lot of different questions people had asked. And one of those lessons was on premillennialism and the rapture. Those notes, that audio, is available at the website thywordistruth.com. The handout gives a list of all the other topics we also considered. You might find some of them of interest, also all available at the website. Verse 5. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he who shares in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and they shall reign with him 1,000 years. A lot of questions there. Who are the rest of the dead in verse 5? This group must be those who died in service to the beast. It's the same group we saw back in chapter 19, verse 21. This is the group that it comes back to life. But they do not come back to life until after the 1,000-year period is over. That is, they have no part in that victory. They have no share in that complete victory. They don't come back to life until after that victory is denoted, is depicted. Verse 6 is the fifth of the seven Beatitudes in this book. We've been counting them. What is the first resurrection that it speaks of? Well, at the end of verse 4 and in verse 5, we read, they came to life. There's a resurrection. And reigned with Christ 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life. There's another resurrection. Until the 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. Well, to which of those two resurrections does the this refer to there in that last verse? Well, verse 6 gives us the answer. Those who are raised in the first resurrection are blessed and holy. Thus, the first resurrection is the resurrection mentioned here at the end of verse 4. Well, if there's a first resurrection, then is there a second resurrection? Yes. The second resurrection is the one mentioned at the beginning of verse 5. Those in the second resurrection are the group that comes to life after the 1,000-year reign of Christ. And we're going to learn more about that group in verse 13. What is the second death in verse 6? Well, the second death is mentioned in contrast to the first death, as we would expect. The first death resulted in these two groups of people we're seeing here in verse 4 and verse 5. We have martyrs that had died And we have the godless who had died. They'd all experienced that first death. Both of them had died. Both groups had died. The first death affected both those who were on Christ's side and those who were opposed to Christ. All experienced the first death. One of those two groups, however, would not die again. The martyrs who came to life would not face the second death. The second death will affect only those who serve the beast. Is the second death the eternal death that awaits them at the end of all time? Well, not necessarily. First, we've been discussing figurative resurrection so far in our study here, so we shouldn't be surprised to perhaps find figurative deaths. Second, although for some the first death was very literal, for most of the Romans it was not. We've already talked about the meaning of the seals and the trumpets and the bowls that led to the first death, the figurative death, the judgment. And many of the Romans were living and continued to live throughout all of those figurative judgments. Third, we should never lose sight of our time frame here. We're going to see it repeated again twice before we get to the end of this book, that the things in this book were to shortly come to pass. And fourth, just as we saw last week that heaven immediately awaits the death of a faithful Christian after death, so too eternal torment immediately awaits the faithless who die. And that was true even before the cross. Think back to the rich man and Lazarus back in Luke 16. Rich man, where did he wake up? He came to in torment. That was before the cross. Thus, even if we're to conclude that the second death is the literal and eternal death that awaits these godless Romans, we don't have to conclude that's a yet future event. They began to suffer that as soon as they literally died. Those who experience the first resurrection will not experience the second death. Instead, they will be preached and will reign with Christ 1,000 years. Was this something new for them? Just like, well, now I begin to have this and I didn't have this before. Is this a status they had not previously enjoyed? Not at all. The church is a royal priesthood. 1 Peter 2:9. Revelation 1, 5, and 6 tells us that we became a kingdom of priests when we were freed from our own sins by the blood of Jesus Christ. These verses in chapter 20 are what we've seen before, a public reaffirmation of something that was already true. The martyrs enjoyed this before their death. They were a kingdom of priests before their death. They reigned in life with Jesus, as do we. They were a royal priesthood in life, as are we. This was a public reaffirmation of that status that they enjoyed. We've seen that before in this book. Verse 7. And when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be loosed from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations which are at the four corners of the earth, that is Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea. And they marched up over the broad earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet were. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Why is Satan not loosed until after the 1,000-year period is ended? Well, that's clear. That's so he will not detract from that picture of complete victory, symbolized by the 1,000 years. That was a complete defeat for him. He can't have any share at all in that complete victory. The little while in verse 3, talked about it a little bit last week, during which Satan is loosed, is contrasted with the 1,000-year reign. Both are periods of time, and both denote a state of affairs, as do periods of time in this book. The church's victory was total and complete, completely complete, 1,000 years. Satan's victories will never be total, never be complete. Satan has not been loosed for 1,000 years. He's been loosed for only a little while. And that is a mark of great comfort to those who understand the symbols in this book. What are Gog and Magog in verse 8? Well, again, we have to go to the Old Testament. We first meet Gog from the land of Magog in Ezekiel chapter 38. In verses 2 and 3 of Ezekiel 38, here's what we read. Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief priest of Meshach and Tubal. Ezekiel 38, verse 17, a little further in that chapter, tells us that God had spoken about Gog in old time by my servants, the prophets of Israel, which prophesied in those days many years that I would bring thee against them. So God had spoken by the prophets about Gog and Magog. Yet where is any such prophecy found in the Bible? In fact, no such prophecy in the Bible mentions Gog by name. But there are many prophecies in the Bible that foretell of heathen enemies of God's people that God would take care of, that he would defeat for his people. That's throughout Scripture. And that is Gog and Magog. Gog and Magog figuratively depict whoever happens to be the current enemy of God's people. That's how he was used in Ezekiel 38. If you look at that entire chapter, what you're going to find is that in that chapter, the Jews had been promised a restored kingdom. And they responded, so what? So what? First there had been Egypt, then there had been the Philistines, and then the Assyrians, and now Babylon. Who's next? How can we put faith in this promise, the people asked. Who's next? What guarantee do we have that the same thing won't happen again? Some great enemy of God's people won't show up with our newly restored kingdom and wipe us off the map. What guarantee do we have that that won't happen? And that's the answer they get in Ezekiel 38. To convince the Jews that under the Messiah, their glory would be secure, Ezekiel uses a symbolic battle with a fictitious Gog from the fictitious land of Magog to show that they would be able to defeat any enemy with the Messiah on their side. There, as here in Revelation, Gog of the land of Magog denotes anybody, yet nobody in particular. No matter who it is that attacks the church, even this great, monstrous army of Gog, the enemy will fare no better than Rome. That's the message here. The meaning of the symbol here is the same as it was in Ezekiel. God's people have just been vindicated from a terrible oppressor. A huge army gathers from all over the world to make war against them. And God defeats that army without his people having to even lift a finger. That's how secure they are in their eternal kingdom of Christ. What God is saying that I've, what he's saying is I've already defeated and vindicated you in this present crisis with Rome. I will do so again anytime and anywhere, no matter who rises up against you. It's a beautiful promise of comfort. Once again, it's a beautiful message for us today. I fear the church today has developed a severe inferiority complex. If at any time the church could have felt inferior and powerless, it was during the Roman persecution. And yet the church then, as now, was anything but inferior, was anything but powerless. Rome was not the eternal kingdom, but there was an eternal kingdom there, the church. That description, the eternal kingdom, applies only to the church. Later in chapter 21, we're going to find out exactly how God views the church of Christ. And he does not view it as inferior in any way. If we see ourselves as inferior, is it any wonder if we find ourselves ineffective? The first step to being the kind of church God wants us to be is to see ourselves as God sees us. And there's no better place to determine how God sees the church than right here in the closing chapters of Revelation. No better place. I fear that the church's neglect and misunderstanding of this great book have hindered the mission of the church. We need to see ourselves as God sees us. In verse 9, the army surrounds the beloved city. What is this city? It's the New Jerusalem. We're going to see later in chapter 21. It's the church. The old Jerusalem was the dwelling place of God's people in the Old Testament. The New Jerusalem is the dwelling place of God's people in the New Testament. And where is that dwelling place? That's the church. That's the beloved city. In verse 10, Satan is cast into a lake of fire to depict his complete and utter defeat. Why has he been completely defeated? Because he has just been told that no matter what he ever does, he will never be able to defeat the church. No matter what he does, no matter what army he raises up against the church, he will never be able to defeat the church. He thought he could do it with Rome, he was wrong. If he thinks he can ever do it, he's wrong. He will never be able to defeat the church. He has been totally and completely defeated. That's the story of his life. Defeat. Utter and complete defeat. That's why he's pictured here as being cast into this lake of fire. Utter and complete defeat. Satan cannot overcome the church. If you're looking for a beautiful takeaway message in one sentence from the entire book of Revelation, that's it. Satan cannot overcome the church. Verse 11. Then I saw a great white throne and him who sat upon it. From his presence, earth and sky fled away. No place was found for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Also another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the books, by what they had done. And the sea gave up the dead in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead in them, and all were judged by what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. We see here in these verses a great judgment scene. Is this the final judgment? It's certainly true that the Roman persecutors and the faithless Christians will one day face a literal final judgment. And it'll be very similar to what's being described here. But similarity of language does not prove identity of subject. We've seen that again and again. The time frame of the book might suggest this is not the final judgment. The context of these verses might suggest this is not the final judgment. Let's avoid the temptation to suddenly jump ahead in time thousands of years. And let's look and see which judgment this is. Could this language be used to describe the final judgment and the church in heaven after the end of all time? Sure it could. Yes it could. Is that what is being described here? I don't think so. And if we have two possible explanations, one occurring shortly after the book was written and one that has yet to occur, shouldn't we prefer the one that occurred shortly after the book was written, since that's what the book tells us four times it's talking about? Although the world will end with a literal judgment, there are many other judgment scenes in the Bible. The picture of God sitting in judgment is a very common one in the Bible, and often refers to events that are not the end of the world. Psalm 9, 4 through 7, the psalmist uses a judgment scene to describe God's past judgments against the enemies of his people. For thou hast maintained my just cause. Thou hast sat on the throne giving righteous judgment. Thou hast rebuked the nations. Thou hast destroyed the wicked. Notice the past tense in those verses from Psalm 9. Daniel 7 is another example. Daniel 7 is a very instructive example, because Daniel 7 is talking about exactly what we see here in this chapter in Revelation. Recall in Daniel 7, the fourth beast was the Roman Empire. And in Daniel 7, verses 9 and 11, listen to what precedes, comes before the destruction of that fourth beast, that Roman Empire. Daniel 7. I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. And I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain. That's coming after that judgment scene. And its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. Does all that sound familiar? It should. We just read it in Revelation, verses 11 through 15. They're describing the same event. In both we have a throne. In both we have an occupant of that throne. In both books are opened. In both we have fire. In both we have Rome. The parallels are inescapable. And Daniel gives us the time of the judgment, the days of the Roman Empire. Well, who is judged here? The dead that are raised in verse 13 are the ones being judged here. Well, who are they? They are the rest of the dead from verse 5. We've seen them before. They're the ones who died in opposition to Christ. They died in service to Rome. They're the ones who were killed by the seals and by the trumpets and by the bowls. These verses show the great contrast of those who stood with Christ and those who stood against Christ. Those who stood with Christ, complete and total victory, 1,000-year reign with Christ. Those who stood with Rome, complete and total defeat, death in a lake of fire. What about the book of life in verse 15? Why is it mentioned? It's mentioned to justify this sentence. This is why they're sent to one place or the other. This is where God looks. We also know from chapters 2 and 3 that there were some in this group who saw only a blotted out spot where their name had been in the book of life. Can you imagine anything worse than looking in that book and knowing your name had once been in that book and seeing only erasure marks where your name had been? Can you imagine anything worse? Talk about an eternity of regret. What about in verse 14 where it says that death and Hades are defeated? Well, that has to be the end of the world, right? Why? If I move that event in any direction, I would not move it later in time. I'd move it earlier in time. Instead, I would move it toward the cross. That was when death and Hades were defeated. Yes, it's certainly true that on the great last day, when we're literally raised incorruptible, it will come to pass that death is swallowed up in victory, 1 Corinthians 15. But it's equally true that death was defeated at the cross and at Christ's resurrection from the dead. Romans 6, 8 through 9, death no longer has dominion over him. That's a defeat for death. The defeat of death is a past event now, it was a past event then. 2 Timothy 1:10, Jesus has abolished death and brought life and immortality to light through the gospel. Past tense. Death had already been defeated. We don't need to rush forward thousands of years in time to find the defeat of death. Why then are death and Hades shown as being defeated here? Because Rome's power of death had been removed. Death is personified in this book. And nowhere is that clearer than in verse 13. Look what it says there. Death gives up its dead. Death is personified in this book. Rome's defeat was Satan's defeat. And Satan's defeat was death's defeat. Rome had used death as a terrible weapon. And yet here are these martyrs, live and well. Death had been defeated. What's left in this book? Chapters 21 and 22 conclude the book with a beautiful description of the triumphant and victorious church. In fact, nowhere will you find a more beautiful description of the church of Christ than in these final chapters of the Bible. Nowhere. The Old Testament ends with a curse. Let's see how the New Testament ends. Chapter 21. The church has just come through a major crisis, and these final two chapters describe the victorious and vindicated church that comes out of that crisis. We're going to hear about the newness of its environment, a new heaven and a new earth. We're going to hear about its beauty, golden streets and jeweled walls. We're going to hear about its purity, beautiful bride. We're going to hear about its stability, its strength, huge walls and a city four square. We're going to hear about its importance and its testimony, a source of light to those living in darkness. Beautiful descriptions of the church of Christ. The question for us will be whether these descriptions of the church apply to the church on earth, then and now, or rather to the church in heaven at the end of time. We already know which of those two options fits better with the time frame, with the context. But is there perhaps some language used in these final chapters that would require us to move these chapters forward in time? We can agree that many of these descriptions that we're going to find here could apply equally well to the church at any time. Now, then, in heaven, at any time. But is that true of all the descriptions in these final two chapters? Could all of them be used to describe the church at any time? Or are perhaps some of these descriptions going to help us determine the time in mind here? Let's stay tuned for that question as we move into chapters 21 and 22. Verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. In chapter 20, verse 11, the earth and the sky fled from the presence of God, and no place was found for them. The figure of heaven and earth passing away is very common in the Bible. God depicts the judgment of the ungodly by figuratively bringing their world to an end, just as He will one day literally bring their world to an end. In Isaiah 13, God dismantles the earth and the stars to depict the judgment of Babylon by the Medes. In Isaiah 34, the heavens are dissolved and rolled together as a scroll to depict the judgment against Edom. Matthew 24:29 describes the judgment of Jerusalem as a day when the sun shall be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, the stars shall fall from heaven, the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And if you look at verse 34 of Matthew 24, just a few verses later, you'll see that happen in the first century. Figurative description of the judgment of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Just as the apocalyptic language in Matthew 24 described the destruction of the Jewish world in Jerusalem, so too does the same language here describe the destruction of the Roman world, the judgment of Rome. Just as things would never again be the same for Jerusalem after that judgment, so too would things never be the same again for Rome. Their old world was gone. Something else was about to take its place, had taken its place. Remember Daniel 2:44. And in the days of these kings, the days of Rome, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. The kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. It shall stand forever. That's what happened to Rome. Their world was dismantled. The eternal kingdom broke it into pieces, as Daniel prophesied 600 years before the fact. What is the new heaven? What is the new earth that takes its place? The language of judgment is often language of destruction. And the language of blessing is often just the opposite, language of creation. That's what we see here. A new heaven and a new earth are created in which the previous oppressor, in this case Rome, does not exist. The creation of a new heaven and a new earth depicts the removal of that earlier enemy, some radical change in circumstances. The particular change has to be determined from the context. In this case, it's Rome, the judgment of Rome. That's the change in circumstances. That's why we have a new heaven and a new earth. Just as we saw that in the Old Testament. Verse 2. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling of God is with men. He will dwell with them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. What is the holy city in verse 2? Well, look at the clues. It's the New Jerusalem. It's prepared as a bride. Many more clues will follow, but from these two clues alone, we know the answer. It's the church. It's the church. Why does verse 1 picture the church as coming down out of heaven? Well, one reason is to show the contrast with the beast. Where did they come from? Up from the earth, up from the sea. Not true with the eternal kingdom. It comes down out of heaven. The church is not the product of man. The eternal kingdom was not made with human hands, unlike the false religions of this world. The church was established by God. I think that's what's shown here. A second reason, though, the church is shown coming down out of heaven is that God's people have been referred to throughout this book as being kept safe and secure in heaven, while God takes care of things down on the earth. Even those Christians still physically living on the earth are pictured in this book as safe and secure in heaven with God. And now that the wicked Romans are gone and their world is gone, the church is pictured as returning to a world that has been made new. It's coming back. God pictures them safe in heaven while he takes care of Rome. Now that Rome is gone, the church is pictured as coming down out of heaven to an earth made new. Rome is no more. The earth is now Rome free, and the church is coming back down to live on earth. Why are there no more tears or death or pain? Verse 4 tells us. It's because the former things have passed away. Well, what are the former things that have just passed away? The bloodthirsty harlot is gone. The two beasts are gone. Rome is no more. The condition of the church has just changed dramatically. But couldn't this same language apply to heaven? Yes, if we took it out of context. The end of the world will certainly bring about a dramatic change of circumstances, but the context suggests a different change is in mind here. But how could the beautiful promises in verse 4 apply to anything other than the end of the world? Well, you could ask Isaiah that same question, because Isaiah used this same language to apply to things that were not the end of the world. Isaiah 25, verse 8, with reference to a deliverance from Moab. He will swallow up death in victory. The Lord will wipe away tears from off all faces. Isaiah 30, verse 19, with reference to a deliverance from Assyria. For the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. Thou shalt weep no more. These promises in Isaiah were intended to emphasize that Israel's past troubles were behind them. Were no more. That's why the language is used here in Revelation. Rome had been judged. The figurative language in verse 4 describes the dramatic change in circumstances that came about as a result of that judgment. So when will all the promises in verse 4 occur? When will every tear be wiped away? When will death be no more? When will there be no more crying and no more pain? Well, verse 3 gives us the answer to that one. Verse 3 says, these promises will occur when the dwelling of God is with men. So when will that happen? Wrong question. We need to ask, when did that happen? 1 Corinthians 3:16 tells us we are God's people. God's Spirit dwells in us. Ephesians 2:22 describes the church how? As a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. God dwells with men now in the church. Christ's perfect sacrifice made that possible. The events in this book were simply a public reaffirmation of what was already true. God is on the church's side. He dwells with us. God dwells in the church, and anyone who persecutes the church will answer to him. He dwells among his people. That's true now. That was true then. These descriptions about crying and tears and pain and death should not be taken literally. This language is symbolic. Everything we've been seeing is figurative. We need to treat this the same way. Here, as in Isaiah, these descriptions depict the state of God's people after some great enemy is removed. What about the phrase, no more death? Well, we've already talked about that. Death played a major role in this book. Death was the primary weapon that Rome used against the church. But when God defeated Rome, he defeated Rome's power to inflict death. Rome would never again have the power of physical death over God's people. Verse 5. He who sat upon the throne said, behold, I make all things new. Also he said, write this, for these words are trustworthy and true. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the fountain of the water of life without payment. He who conquers shall have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the polluted, as for murderers, fornicators, sorcerers, idolaters, all liars, their lot shall be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. All things are new. The former things, that is Rome, passed away. The church now finds itself in a new environment. The world of Rome has been judged. A new world has been created for the church. It is done. Satan and Rome have been defeated. Their world has been destroyed. The blood of the martyrs has been vindicated. A new world has been created that does not include Rome. The church has come down from heaven to enjoy its new environment. Everything has been finished with regard to Rome. The second death in verse 8, the death in chapter 20 that was reserved for those who were on Rome's side. Did that second death include only Romans? No, did not. Verse 8 tells us it includes the cowardly, the faithless, and the polluted. It includes those former Christians who renounced Christ in order to save their skin. It includes those who saved their life only to lose it. How does God view those who compromise with this world? Cowards, faithless, polluted. Verse 9. Then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues and spoke to me, saying, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." What are we about to see here? Heaven? No. The angel says we're about to see the bride, the wife of the Lamb. We're about to see the church, the victorious church. The real question is not what we're about to see, but rather when are we seeing it? Are we about to see the church in heaven after the final judgment of the world? Or are we about to see the church back on earth safe and sound after the judgment of Rome? We've already had a first clue that should help us answer that question. Look again at verse 2. There John saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride. We see the same clue in verse 10. Not only are we not looking at heaven in these verses, we're looking at the church coming down out of heaven. We're not even looking at the church in heaven. We're looking at the church coming down out of heaven. We're seeing the church coming down from heaven. Keep that in mind as we continue on through this beautiful description. Verse 10. And in the Spirit he carried me away to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, its radiance like a most rare jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gate 12 angels, and on the gates the name of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel were inscribed. On the east 3 gates, on the north 3 gates, on the south 3 gates, on the west 3 gates, and the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. This beautiful chapter parallels Ezekiel chapter 40, and you need to read Ezekiel 40, also describing the church. That's a book that we went through in our classes here, and all of our notes are available on the web for Ezekiel 40. Please look up the notes on Ezekiel chapter 40. Ezekiel's vision of the temple in that chapter also take place while Ezekiel's on a high mountain. It's also describing the church. In verse 10, John sees the holy city coming down from heaven. Coming down from heaven into this Rome-free world that God has created in which it can dwell. Verse 11 tells us that this city has the glory of God. That's true because the church of Christ is the body of Christ. That's true because, as Hebrews 1:3 tells us, Christ is the brightness of His glory and the express image of His person. The city is the church of Christ. This city has 12 gates, guarded by 12 angels, names of 12 tribes, 12 foundations, 12 apostles. How can anyone read the descriptions of this city and not understand that numbers are used symbolically in this book? How can anyone read this description and not understand that? 12 is the number of God's people, and this city is the dwelling place of God's people. 12, 12, 12, 12, 12. Over and over again. 12, 12, 12. God's people. Ephesians 2:20 tells us the church is built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets. This city of God is the church of Christ. And so far, we have not seen a single description of that city of God that does not apply to the church right here and right now, as much as it applied to the church in John's day. And we will pick up next week with verse 15 and finish this wonderful book of Revelation. Thank you so much for your attention.